Hello everyone, this is Brian Ferguson, the host of Bumps and Thumps, the Talk of Wrestling. I want to tell you about a new podcast out called Fouls Count Anywhere. It is a classic pro wrestling podcast that brings you the legends of wrestling with true wrestling fans Chris DiCarlo and Charlie Turner. They bring on guests that are legends in this business, as well as wrestlers of today, promoters, referees, you name it. They have them on there, folks. And I encourage you to listen to them. If you're on YouTube, watch them. They drop every Saturday. They have their podcast. They drop it in the afternoon. So look forward to that podcast coming out. Fouls Count Anywhere podcast with Chris DiCarlo and Charlie Turner. Folks, you will not be disappointed. I guarantee it. And enjoy the podcast. Welcome to another edition of Bumps and Thumps, the Talk of Wrestling. I'm Brian Ferguson. My guest today is considered one of the greatest ring announcers in pro wrestling, if not the greatest, in my opinion. He has worked in many territories and promotions and is best known for his time in the AWA, WCW, and the WWF. He has also written a book titled Body Slams, Memoirs of a Wrestling Pitch Man. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to introduce Mr. Gary Michael Capetta. Gary, thanks for coming on today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
You know, I remember you as a kid. We were talking a little bit before we went live or recording here. And I remember you mainly in the AWA when I was a kid. WWF later, obviously, and WCW. You did do some territorial work. Of those places you have been, what was one of your favorite, either promotions, territory, whatever you want to call it, that you really enjoyed working in?
There are favorites for different reasons. Okay. I couldn't just give you one, but when I was with WWF, which is now WWE, I was with them for 11 years. So they were exciting years because they were my first years. Okay. So the first, for instance, Meadowlands or Philadelphia Spectrum, where there were 20,000 in attendance, that was exciting for that period of time. Mm-hmm. And then when I left there and I went with Vern Gagne, we did the first pro wrestling show on ESPN. So that was the first national audience. That was exciting for that reason. Yeah. And then WCW was the first time that I was full-time in any wrestling promotion, traveling, you know, as much as 250 days a year, doing their weekly TV, their live specials, and then their house shows, their non-televised house shows. So I think I was probably the first full-time ring announcer. Like, that's what I did. I didn't work in the office in any way. I have a lot of firsts, you know, like historically.
Yeah.
And then I did backstage interviewing with Ring of Honor, and that was exciting because that was very innovative, a very innovative product compared to the big three that I had worked with previously. So there were exciting times at different parts of my 50 years for different reasons.
Yeah. Wow. I still remember you in the 80s when you worked in the AWA under Vern Gagne. Mm-hmm. That's where I really saw you first. What was it like working for Vern? I hear different things, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. Yeah.
I've heard different things too, but just my personal experience, my experiences were all positive. He was maybe a little distant from current trends at the time, but other than that, he always treated me well. He always delivered on what he promised. He was He was also interested in you as a person. He thought of you. Just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, he brought me out to Minneapolis to do WrestleRock at the Hubert H. Humphrey Metrodome. So that was where his offices were. And he had his secretary call me the next morning, knowing that my flight wasn't until late in the afternoon, wanting to know what I was doing that day. And so I didn't have to wait at the airport. He sent a car for me and brought me to his offices so he can show me his video, his TV suite. And that was, so I hung out with him and Greg, and I think it was Larry Zbysko. So it was, he thought of you in that way. And to me, that says a lot. So I have only positive things to say about Vern.
Well, that's good. Like I said, you hear different things. The two things I've heard consistently, though, about him, you get paid well and you got time off as far as the wrestlers go. So,
Well,
and what about work?
I
Go
was
ahead.
part-timer with him. So he did pay well. And I was on the first episodes for almost a year of his ESPN show, for as long as it was in Atlantic City before they relocated to Las Vegas. Because I was teaching school. I'm an educator by trade, so I wasn't available to travel out midweek to Las Vegas. So I had he was a little distant sometimes, but his persona to me was like a politician. He would always arrive like dressed very nattily, and very like scrubbed, and always with the hand out and the shake and the big smile, and that was the Vern that I knew.
Polished and ready to go, right?
But there are other promoters, bookers that have gotten mixed reviews, like Bill Watts, who I worked with, like Ole Anderson, who I worked with, and I never had a problem with either of them. There were very few that didn't understand what I did and didn't show appreciation for what I did. There are a couple of them, but there are very few.
Let's go back a little bit, what you said earlier, if we could, Gary, about what you did outside of the ring. You said you were an educator. So let's talk about that a little bit, if we could. What did you teach? Obviously, you went to college if you were an educator. So can we talk a little bit about that, your childhood growing up and getting into the educating business?
Sure. Well, I grew up in New Jersey and went to college in New Jersey. And I taught secondary education. So it's grades 7 through 12, mostly in a high school. Most of my years, and as time went on, I was in and out because I left in 1989 when I went with WCW full time. And then after I finished my stint with WCW, they called me back and I went back into the classroom. I was a Spanish teacher. And the last few years, I was a Spanish teacher for a school called Christian Brothers Academy. It was a private all boys Catholic school. And the last 3 years that I was there, I chaired the language department. So before, then I retired. So yeah, I loved teaching there, and they kept hiring me. They hired me four different times, to tell you the truth, from 85 till not too long ago. So yeah, I had a good experience with them.
Great. That's something I didn't know. I had no idea you were a Spanish teacher.
Well, an educator is someone that communicates information, so does an announcer. There
Definitely.
are parallels. When I wrote my book, which I can't believe came out 23 years ago, in 2000, the first edition, which went on to be really a successful book, along with Have a Nice Day, Mick Foley. It was, we had two of the first books of the newer generation. So like quite a few of the things that I did were a bit innovative, including getting back to my point. I understand that not everybody reads. Not everybody is an avid reader. Not everybody has the time to. So people educate themselves, inform themselves in different ways. You know, some people listen to books on tape, for instance. And another first was I created the one-man shows, which for a lot of the wrestlers, it's really a Q&A. But I did a stage show, and this was back in 2002. Had not been done before, because I understood that telling a story and showing video overhead as I'm telling the story is another way to communicate information, to inform your public, which is why I did what I did. The first one we did was at Christopher Newport University in Virginia. George Steele, the animal, was my guest. And we drew about 500 people, because that was new. That was kind of amazing. And then later, a couple months later, I did it at the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame induction weekend up in New York State. So, it wasn't until it was like 2017 or so that I brought it back out on the road. But it was a full 2-hour stage show. It was loosely scripted. There is interaction with the crowd, but it was a real like stage show. It wasn't just I'm answering it's not a Q&A, although I had a Q&A at the end of the show.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of fun with that. I brought that back out. Oh man, I went as far, I don't know, my base was Jersey. I brought it as far west as Chicago.
Oh wow.
Louisville and Indianapolis, and as far north as Massachusetts, and as far south as Tampa, Orlando. So as an educator, it was another way of informing. That was my whole point.
Did you ever wonder what could have been with the AWA had things gone differently? Had their fortunes gone differently? Had certain wrestlers not left and perhaps more money would have been at the disposal of the Gagnas? Well, wonder no further. You can go to Brad Drake's YouTube channel and experience the 1987 Supermod for yourself. As Brad Drake starts off in May 1987, along with Greg Gagne, Baron Von Rotschke, Vern Gagne himself, Nick Bockwinkel, Larry Zbysko, Kurt Hennig, and a slew of others as he plays and saves the AWA.
Sounds like you're an innovator. It's really quite interesting. You know, I didn't know this stuff. And I'll full disclosure to our fans, and I told you this earlier, I didn't know you had a book out, which is kind of embarrassing for me because I'm pretty active as a pro wrestling fan, that you didn't have a book until the other day when I was researching it. I have ordered it, though.
I was teasing you about it, but you know that it's not a necessarily bad thing because this book just keeps on selling. It's been with the current publisher since 2006, and so, I don't think they'd keep it on their active list if it wasn't. And I know that you keep selling. It's my number one seller when I go out and do conventions.
Oh yeah. Well, I can imagine. I mean, I've read the reviews on it. Like I said, I'm going to read it. It sounds like a great book, so I'm excited to get it.
It was a lot of fun.
Well,
when I finished WCW, so by that time, I had 21 years in pro wrestling. And it was difficult to... One day you're full time, and then the next day you've retired from that part of your career. So to let go is very difficult. And that was a therapeutic little exercise of like letting go little by little by little by sharing 20 at that time, 21 years of experiences and memories. And I mean, I didn't really expect it to turn into a book. It was just a little therapy that I set up for myself.
Yeah.
But 2 years I sat home, and every day over those 2 years, didn't go to any other kind of job. I either wrote or edited every day, and I loved it. It was,
yeah,
it was great.
Wow. It does take quite a while to write a book. Cause you gotta edit it, like you said, write it. And sometimes you gotta do research on yourself even, you know, like, did I do that? Could I, what else did I do? Things like that. So I'm sure it was therapeutic and challenging.
Once you realize that, okay, this is heading towards a book, now you have to start thinking about, how do I get it out there? You know, 23 years ago, it wasn't as easy as it is today to put content online. Online in the 90s was in its infancy. So I went the old school route of getting an agent to seek out a publisher. And that took up a bunch of time too.
Yeah, I can imagine. Wow. Hey everyone, this is Brian Ferguson. Fans of the AWA, you are in for a real treat. My friend Joyce Poshin has just released her book titled My Ringside Seat to the AWA. Joyce writes about her personal experiences with wrestlers such as Nick Bockwinkel, Lord Alfred Hayes, Baron Von Raschke, and others. Joyce also has published many photos from her collection that you will not see anywhere else. Order today by email at joyce.poshin@gmail.com. Payment is through PayPal. The book is only $20 plus $6 shipping and handling. International orders, please email Joyce for shipping charge. Folks, run, don't walk to your keyboard, and order today. And enjoy the podcast. So if we could go back a little bit further. So growing up, Gary, what, your childhood, if you could tell us a little bit about that, your family, and then how you got interested in wrestling. I mean, was there somebody in your family that started watching it and you watch it with them, or how did that come about?
That's the normal way. One of the first things I do at my stage show is I ask the audience, how did you find wrestling? Exactly what you're asking me. And 9 times out of 10, they were introduced by someone in their family, could be a grandparent, or a parent, or it was a friend. It was somebody usually that was important in their lives. And I think that's why pro wrestling stays near and dear to their hearts, is because their formative years and growing up are tied into pro wrestling. For me, it was a little different. For me, I was just flipping the channels late one night and came across this. I didn't know what it was, this exhibition. I didn't think I was old enough to be watching this, because it was, think about what it mean back then and today, you know, it's really prettied up today, but back then it was kind of drab. It was just a darkened space with a light in the center and two scantily dressed men that are sweating and that are throwing each other around. And it's like, what is this? Like, I thought it was something I shouldn't be watching. And then I was in fifth, sixth grade. So this, just to give you an idea of like where my, you know, I didn't know. And the next week when I found it again for it, there were women in bathing suits. This is what my 11-year-old brain is processing. There are women in, and they're doing the same thing. And there are people that looked kind of normal sitting around, and they're hooting and they're hollering. And then when I saw the midgets, it was like, wow, this is really cool. So because back then you didn't admit at school that you were a wrestling fan. It was like you were a closet fan, or you were made fun of, as opposed to a baseball or basketball or football fan. So Yeah, that's how I found it.
Wow. I understand that wrestling fan, the closet. I was like that until probably, oh gosh, 84, 85, when it went pretty much mainstream, when then it was cool. And then all my friends were like, aren't you a wrestling fan? I was like, yeah, I am. But, you know, I didn't really want to say anything before. So I get it. I understand that.
And now look at your room.
And now look at my room. Yeah,
you can't get away from it.
This is the only room I'm allowed to have decorated like this. My wife, I get one space.
Well, you're lucky that you have the one, you know?
I know, right?
Some guys don't even get the one.
No, they don't. Oh, all right. So if we could, Gary, remembering your first match, being in that ring, what was that like for you?
That was surreal. Because I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, the very first time I stepped into the ring?
Mm-hmm. Very first time.
Okay, but the first challenge was how to get into a ring. It's not as simple as it looks the first time you do it. Like, I would never, nor should a ring announcer ever vault over the top rope. And I'm not going to like roll in under the bottom rope. That would be not appropriate. So now what do you do? Like, if you have never negotiated that before and there are 1,500, 1,800 people watching you try to figure out whether to go through the top two ropes or the bottom two ropes. So that was embarrassing, because right there and then they knew I didn't have a clue. The fans knew. And that was turned out to be a good thing, because it made me like a regular guy, and it gave them another target to another person to harass, and they did. Interestingly enough, the first match that I introduced, and the first person that I introduced was a guy by the name of Pretty Boy Larry Sharp, who created the Monster Factory in New Jersey, the wrestling training school, back when there were very few of them. Mm-hmm. And it was his first match. So our careers began at the same time. It was, wow. I think it was July 6th, 1974. So in introducing him for his first match, first time I'm ever in the ring. So that was interesting. And the main event had my childhood hero, Bruno Sammartino. So you can imagine, it was Sammartino versus Nikolai Volkov. This was in Wildwood, New Jersey at the convention hall.
Wow.
So yeah, I was really nervous. Not only am I standing just feet away from my childhood hero, but I'm introducing him, and it's a very public spectacle. So it was and I was never allowed in the locker room, so I had no interaction with any of the wrestlers outside of the ring for about a year and a half, 2 years.
Wow.
That's how long it took for them to trust me.
Yeah, back then, kayfabe, excuse me, was pretty solid. They didn't give away nothing. So let's kind of talk about that if we could a little bit. So you were in the business for quite a few years. Transitioning, going from, you know, a weekly TV show at a TV studio to the, you know, the big arenas, you know, on Nitro and where if you were on Raw, things like that. What was that like for you? I mean, seeing that huge transition, like from the 80s going into the 90s, that transformation of weekly television when you're a ring announcer, that had to be kind of mind-boggling or mind something.
Well, I started announcing for the weekly TV show, the WWF at the time, only 2 years into announcing. So that came early on. And once I was on weekly television, then I started at the larger arenas that were local to me. So there were two of them. There was the Meadowlands and the Philadelphia Spectrum. So it all was like pretty gradual. And I can't say like they made a huge impact. It was, you know, obviously it's always more exciting, you know, when there are tens of thousands of people that are present. But by the time I did that, I had been doing local venues for 2 years. So I pretty much knew what I was doing. It took me 7 years before I felt like I hit my stride, but it was all very gradual. And then when I was with WCW and we traveled through Canada and Europe, that was very cool, because you can be doing the TV and not really appreciating or realizing that what you're doing is being viewed by people all over the world. So yeah, that when you're in Europe and people are recognizing you, I mean, that really hits you the first time that happens. That's pretty neat. Even though you know that it's being broadcast around the world, until you experience the recognition by the folks in the different countries, it doesn't have the same impact.
Yeah. No, I can imagine. Wrestling fans, promoters, wrestlers, and anyone who enjoys pro wrestling now have something new to be excited about. The Wrestling Fans International Association, the WFIA, is back. WFIA is an association that exists to promote, grow, and support professional wrestling throughout the world. Membership is free. Your membership includes a free digital bi-monthly publication of the Wrestling Fan News newsletter, association updates, voting privileges, and much more. Please go to thewfia.org, that's thewfia.org, and become a member today. So when you went full-time with WCW, traveling, what was that like on your family life, your personal life? Was it challenging? Was it it's okay, you know, I'll you know, what was that like?
I love the life. So I love traveling. I really like, I love driving. But when I entered WCW, I put in some, and I got them to agree to, and I represented myself in the beginning, certain provisions that I felt needed to be in order for me to remain sane. And one of those was, they would cover your expenses if you traveled three to a car. So if there were three wrestlers or more in a car, they would cover your rental car.
Okay.
And they flew everybody around. So you know that. But I also had built in employee perks as opposed to independent contractors. So they also paid for my food on the road. They paid for I was out of that three person will cover you. I was able to travel alone. I knew that I couldn't, I knew my personality, and there was no way that I was going to be able to survive being in a closed space with the same people every single day. And I also feared I'd wind up being like a gopher and dropping guys off at the gym. And it's like, no. I enjoyed traveling with wrestlers, but when I wanted that to happen, and then I would share my benefits with them. Because they took care of everything. They flew everyone around. They took care of my hotel. I had a food stipend. Even parking at the airport, they took care of. They took care of ground transportation, like to for someone to drive me from home to the airport, and then back at the end of the trip. So I had employee benefits and performer's money. So that was sweet. That was real sweet. So I had the best of all possible scenarios. And I liked the life. So ordinarily, a wrestler will sleep in the city where they've just wrestled. My way was a little different. I like to travel through the night. So at the end of a show, I'd hop in the car and drive 4 or 5 hours to the next city. And then they were more liberal with hotel rooms and when you can check out and when you had to check, you know, when you could check in, when you had to check out. So you can get like a late checkout or an early check-in. The airports were easy to get in and out of because it was before the security that they have today.
Yeah.
The folks that travel today, I mean, they must spend 60% of their day in an airport. We used to be able to pull up to an airport less than an hour before flight time, drop off the rental car, and make our way down to the gate and have plenty of time left over. Obviously you can't do that today.
No, you can't.
Loved the life. It was great, but I had all the benefits for it.
Wow. That sounds like, yeah, sounds like you got a good deal.
I did.
Yeah.
And I was just fortunate.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. So we could talk a little bit, Gary, about wrestlers that you worked with later on. Obviously, you said it took 2 years for you to kind of get into people trusting you in the locker room and things. Who was one of your favorite people wrestler-wise that you really enjoyed working with? They just put a smile on your face or made you feel good, something like that.
Well, that would have to be Gorilla Monsoon.
Yeah.
He at the time that I started in 1974, I didn't know it at the time, but he was a co-owner of the WWF. And he was the person that called me to bring me in on a regular basis. And he also was the producer of their TV show. And he called me in and put me on television. And he and I became very close. I would spend time at his house. He also lived in New Jersey. He had a pool table in his basement, where he would have, guys over and just to socialize, to hang out. He showed concern about me personally. Mm-hmm. So he was like a big brother to me in those early years.
Wow. Gorilla Monsoon. Yeah. A lot of people loved him and respected him. I know Bobby the Brain Heenan absolutely adored him. He thought he was one of the greats.
I'm looking forward to, there's a biography coming out in the spring on Gorilla Monsoon.
So yes.
I interviewed for it. So I'm looking forward to it.
Oh yeah. Brian R. Solomon, right? I believe he was writing the book. Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw that online. It looks, he's a good writer too. So I know it'll be a good book. He's a very good writer.
Publisher.
Okay. Yeah. There you go. That's great. So promotion wise, I know you're mainly on the East Coast for quite a while. Is that correct? Is that what I'm assuming most of your time?
The territory time. Yes.
The territory time. What was one of your favorite promotions during that time that you just enjoyed working for?
There was only one promotion. It was just WWF. It was in that. Remember, once again, I was in the classroom every morning.
Yep.
Didn't matter where I announced the night before, because we would do our TV shows on Tuesday nights and Wednesday nights, and that was about 3 hours from where I lived. So right after school, I'd hop in the car and make it to that show. And you finish at 11 and another 3 hours back home and, you know, 2 or 3 hours sleep and in the classroom in the morning. So I didn't have a whole lot of socializing time with other people in the sport.
Right.
Because I never skipped school to, maybe I wasn't like 100% there mentally, but I always needed that. I used to buy, to keep me awake, like, because remember, I'm up at 6 o'clock in the morning to, you know, to be in the classroom, and driving home late at night, like 2 in the morning or so, there were these all night Howard Johnson's. And Howard Johnson's was known for, I think it was 39 varieties of ice cream. So I would stop and pick up a pint of ice cream, and I would eat it, like not with a spoon, but just out of the container so that it would like go up my nose and on my face. And that would keep me awake for the last leg of my trip home.
Wow.
Yeah, but I mean, you have to really love what you're doing in order to do that.
Yeah, you do. It sounds like it. So nowadays, you know, you wrote your book in 2000. You've done a lot of conventions. You're on social media. I see these amazing photos and posters from the territory era that when you were working there. What is that like when you get that stuff out and you're going to put something on social media, bringing back memories for you? Does it, like, sometimes make you feel like, gosh, I wish somebody call me and do some announcing? Or do you do some announcing? Or
I do.
What's going on with it?
I do. Okay. I was out a couple times this summer. In fact, okay. Your neck of the woods. A year and a half ago, I was actually in Wisconsin.
Okay.
But this summer, I was in St. Paul for Midwest All-Star Wrestling. They had a little convention. They inducted Nikita Koloff and Ken Patera.
Yeah.
And Eddie Sharkey into the Minnesota Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, which I didn't know existed. And then that night, I introduced the main event.
Okay.
And then I was out in Tampa earlier in the summer. And this just a couple weeks ago, I was in Pennsylvania and New York City. So, yeah, either conventions or guest announcing. I still get out a dozen times a year.
All right. So last question here. You got any upcoming events coming up here next few weeks?
No, I just finished probably what I'm going to be doing for the rest of the year.
Okay.
You never know. You know, I get calls all the time.
Yeah.
To answer your question about like the memorabilia, like I have stuff here, like this is a Pro Wrestling Illustrated from, I think it was 2001, mm-hmm. January 2001. So I moved, I relocated to Florida the beginning of this year.
Oh.
So I went through everything and organized everything and cataloged, and I'm still putting tapes.
Wow.
These are, you know, VHS tapes on digital.
Yeah.
So this is taking forever. This happens to be AWA from Atlantic City.
Wow.
So my point being, and this the significance of this Pro Wrestling Illustrated magazine. It's the first and I think only time that a book was excerpted in a magazine like this.
Oh, yeah, there it is. I see it. Yep, Body Slams. Yeah.
So this was the
Armstead
scissor fight in England. Yeah, so I've been through and I keep going through all of these, my collectibles, and I bring some of the collectibles with me when I do conventions. I had WCW pay-per-view posters with me the last time I was out. So, yeah, so I had to go through everything in catalog. It was my point, because I recently moved. So it's as organized as it's probably ever going to get. This is the program from that 2002 Body Slams stage show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Gaines Theater, Christopher Newport University.
Wow.
All kinds of things like that.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I'm glad you're so active on social media too, because I love seeing your posts about, you know, when you have those posters up or you have a photo or, you know, things like that. It just brings back so many memories for me, and I know for a lot of fans out there. It's great. We love it. You know, you're one of the ring announcers that really, honestly, for my generation, really can remember. You know, ring announcers are you know, a key component, but you just had that it factor, I think, because if I say Gary Capetta, they're going to know who I'm talking about if they're a wrestling fan.
Thank you. And, I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, it's been such an honor. Folks, one more time, Mr. Gary Michael Capetta. If you haven't got his book, Body Slams, Memoirs of a Wrestling Pitchman, get it. I'm embarrassed to say I don't have it yet, and I'm getting it.
And they can find me on Facebook at my initials, GMC number 4 Real.
Okay.
GMC for Real, and then simply Gary Capetta on Twitter X.
Right, X now, yeah. All right, folks, yeah, I'll have that, all that information about his book, his social media, and the description. One more time, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Gary Michael Capetta. Sir, thank you for coming on today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was fun. I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Folks, if you're watching, thank you. If you're listening, thank you. If you haven't subscribed, please do so, and we will talk to you soon.